I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. My friends and fellow Americans, it's the last weekend. 16 million voters in 30 states have already cast early ballots, but it's estimated that 130 million may show up on Tuesday. In a minute, some of the challenges we might all encounter on Election Day. But first, candidates, running mates, surrogates, supporters, and Joe the Plumber, who it was announced today just got an agent and may have a book deal, are all out trying to win over the shrinking pool of undecideds and keep the wavering in the fold. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of ABC News The Note, joins us. And Rick, you write today that as we turn the final corner on this race, it depends on your point of view.
Well, yeah, and in the spirit of Halloween, I think that Barack Obama wants you to be scared of something that's in the rearview mirror, and John McCain wants you to be scared of something that's coming into view in that front windshield. And what I mean by that is Barack Obama trying to make this campaign about the Bush years, about tying John McCain to President Bush and saying, look how bad things were over these past 8 years. We can't go back there. John McCain sees what's going on right now in this election, knows that Barack Obama is ahead, knows that the country is growing more comfortable with him, the possibility of him being president. So trying to just highlight aspects of his record that are a little more extreme, a little more liberal, talk about taxes, talk about the war on terror, and try to find any way he can to gain some traction back.
Well, of course, John McCain is saying, you know, if you feel that way, you should have run against George Bush. And Barack Obama is saying, geez, what's next? I mean, are you going to say that I shared my toys and my peanut butter and jelly sandwich in kindergarten? I'm no socialist. So both candidates responding to the charges. And you write both a little bit scared of their running mates. Now, the New York Times writes this morning that Joe Biden has been hitting the back roads. Maybe there's fear that he might make another major gaffe. On the McCain side, a New York Times CBS News poll shows that doubts about Sarah Palin have become a real weight on McCain.
That's right. And it's interesting. Joe Biden, no one would have thought that he could be boring on the campaign trail, but that's exactly what's happened. They're putting him in front of a teleprompter, telling him to read speeches and not say anything. He's already provided a lot of grist for Republicans in this campaign, and the Obama campaign wants to make sure that doesn't happen anymore. So they're limiting any kind of contact he has with voters and with the press. Sarah Palin, oddly, is more accessible now to the press than Joe Biden, but the accessibility hasn't worked. And we're seeing in poll after poll people saying that they're less likely to vote for John McCain because of Sarah Palin. She is invigorating the base. She has people on the Republican side more excited about this election than they were before, but it has had a backlash with the independents, with the moderate voters that they need to win. There's just not enough Republican-based voters out there to win in 2008. You need the independent voters, and they have, by and large, said they don't consider Sarah Palin to be qualified, and some of them are even questioning John McCain's judgment for choosing her.
Let's move on to what the strategy is from here on out. Very short amount of time. You report that the McCain campaign seems to have made a strategic decision to move some money from Tuesday's ground operations into a weekend advertising blitz?
They are just so sick of being outspent in these states. They know that they need to win Ohio. They need to win Florida. They need to win Pennsylvania as well. Those are the three big states. They always come up in presidential years. John McCain in tough spot in all three. They know they have to try to match the Obama air operation, which is just impossible to do at this point. So they are pulling some resources out of the ground, and that just gives another little advantage to Barack Obama.
Well, here's the numbers from the Wisconsin Advertising Project. Obama, the campaign, has spent nearly $21.5 million on advertising, and McCain has spent about $7.5 million. By the way, is Barack Obama going to have to answer to that, you know, down the road, that he's perhaps really set back the whole campaign financing issue?
I've got to think that they will have to address it shortly after a new administration takes office. If he does win, it's clear that the campaign finance system is broken. If Barack Obama could opt out of it and break his promise like he did and run for president anyway. So I think that's one of many agenda items that they would have to take up. But a lot of folks on the Republican side feel like he has not been held to adequate account for having broken that pledge.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Obama is in Iowa and Indiana. What's the strategy on that side?
Those are both states that went for George W. Bush in 2004. They are both states that are in play right now. It is part of the offensive strategy that Barack Obama has. He's also expanding ad buys into new states, even at this late date, including Arizona, John McCain's home state. It just tells you how the flexibility they have because of the enormous amount of money that they've been able to raise and the way that they have been able to successfully expand the map and make states competitive that were never thought that were going to possibly be in play.
Quick mention, interesting surrogates out for the candidates. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is doing a 5-day, 7-state trip for McCain, and the Obama campaign is sending former Vice President Al Gore to Florida,
a place he's familiar with.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger in Ohio as well. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABC News, The Note. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And by the way, that spending on advertising number that we mentioned, about $21 million for Barack Obama, almost $8 million for John McCain, is just Tuesday to Tuesday of last week. It does not include Barack Obama's primetime infomercial. There's a lot of money. Well, you know, we mentioned Joe the Plumber, the Ohio man who's become a centerpiece of the John McCain campaign. Did you know that he's not registered to vote? Joe Wurzelbacher, with an O, is, but the real Wurzelbacher with a U is not. It's a typo. Typos have become a big concern of voting advocates who say that thousands of voters may be disenfranchised because new laws require states to match voters to state databases and their name may be misspelled, as Joe's is. Add to that concerns about voting machines, millions of newly registered voters, predictions of a huge turnout, 130 million voters maybe, and some states scrambling to round off enough poll workers. Well, electionline.org, a nonpartisan research group, calls this a perfect storm. Let's take a closer look today with Edward Foley, professor at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He joins us from WOSU in Columbus. Ned, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, lawsuits are flying. Voters in the Republican Party have filed lawsuits challenging the way elections are being run in Colorado, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Virginia. We know there was a ruling in Pennsylvania on Wednesday that you think was particularly important. Tell us about that.
In Pennsylvania, the request is to have backup emergency paper ballots in case the machines fail. And the standard that the court adopted was to say that if there's a 50% failure rate in terms of the machines in any particular polling place, there's got to be adequate backup paper ballots to make sure that voters can still be processed and move through the lines. And the good news is the government has decided not to appeal this ruling, so this will now be in effect, and I think it's an important precedent about the nature of voting rights.
Well, it highlights a couple of things. First of all, Pennsylvania is one of the states that didn't have early voting, so they're really expecting a lot of people because the votes didn't get siphoned off during early voting. And secondly, there are states that have machines that people have questions about that don't have paper backups.
That's true, and both those points are key here. Early voting is working right now to help handle the unprecedented demand. And the states like Pennsylvania that don't have early voting are at greater risk of problems on Tuesday.
Right. And when I say paper backup, by the way, I'm not talking about just a paper ballot to give someone if a machine breaks down. There's concerns that once a machine breaks down, it might wipe out the votes that were already cast in the machine, and there's no paper trail of those votes.
Yes, that is a vulnerability in some states, not all states, but some states still use only the so-called touchscreen machines, and they don't have what's called a voter-verified paper trail that would allow a voter to look as they're casting their vote and say, is the machine recording what I want it to record? And there was a bill pending in Congress for the last couple of years trying to make it a national requirement that all states have that backup system, but it did not get adopted. And so although many states on their own initiative have done that, not all states have.
Yeah. Well, staying in Pennsylvania, yesterday a judge there refused the state Republican Party's request to order the community organizing group ACORN to turn over a list of 140,000 voters that ACORN had registered. Now, we know there was a battle in Ohio as well between Republicans and the Secretary of State there, a Democrat, over another list of voters, 200,000, whose names didn't match voter registration lists. Now, the Republicans want to be able to challenge these mismatched names at the polls. This goes back to the Joe the Plumber problem we were talking about. Tell us more about concerns over these names that don't match the databases.
Sure. What seems to be going on in Pennsylvania and in Ohio is an effort to examine just how many of the new registrations might be potentially problematic. It's likely that it's very innocent in this sense, meaning it's an eligible voter. It's just a typo, again, like Joe the Plumber or like many other examples that have happened. On the other hand, there are some stories that are emerging in Ohio and elsewhere that some of the new registrations are faulty, either duplicates or individuals that don't seem to be associated with the state of Ohio. There is some evidence on the ground that people have come to Ohio knowing that it's a swing state temporarily for the purposes of participating in Ohio's presidential vote when they're really from New York or California or elsewhere. Again, I don't want to be alarmist about this. I don't know that the volume is especially high, but it is something to look out for. And so what the claim in these lawsuits is, let's just see the evidence. Let's just see how big a problem it is.
Well, we know that in Ohio, the courts there denied the Republicans the opportunity to look at a list of votes that didn't match on the voter registration lists. But isn't this all going to be settled at the polls anyway? I mean, we hear that it's very rare that voter registration fraud becomes voter fraud because you can't get past the safety nets at the polls.
Yes, I think that's accurate. Quite innocently, an individual could have more than one registration form on file because, you know, if you go to the mall and there's a group that's registering voters, you might have forgotten that you registered if you didn't vote in the last election, so you submit the form. That's not fraud. It's a little bit of a mistake, but it's not a problem, assuming as likely to be true, that you're only going to show up once at the polling place. And even if, as again, extremely unlikely, you tried to show up twice, you know, you would have already signed the poll book. So that's a good example, it seems to me, where even if there are problems with the registration lists, it doesn't translate into problems on election day at the polling places. Certainly not in anything like the volume of potential concerns about the registration lists themselves.
Well, in Colorado, a federal court just decided that tens of thousands of voters whose registrations were flagged by Republicans and who had been removed from the rolls will be allowed to vote using provisional ballots, the court saying that the burden is on the state to prove later that the votes are not eligible. Now, a listener has written us to remind us that you can't just throw out registrations, for instance, for Mickey Mouse, because if you go on these online phone line sites, there are people named Mickey Mouse. At least they're registered with phone numbers and addresses across the country. So you can't throw them out. A judge in Michigan issued a similar ruling there.
Right. Errors can be made in both directions. I mean, one of the things that we're learning is that managing our election system is very much a work in progress. And this is the first presidential election that has the new database requirements put into law by Congress. This was a law enacted after the problems of 2000. And there are some duplications and some data entry errors that make it less than ideal. But I think we're definitely seeing this year we need more than the first step. And what we have to do, you know, between now and Tuesday and the aftermath of Tuesday is do the best job that we can to have an election where we're confident in the result, knowing that the system has structural weaknesses that are emerging and that are becoming visible.
That's Edward Foley, an elections law expert at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He'll be back in a minute, but a quick note. Yesterday, a judge in Pennsylvania gave the okay allowing voters to wear campaign T-shirts or buttons when voting, but he expressed concerns about the legal basis for letting voters wear partisan attire when poll workers and watchers can't. On the other hand, in Virginia, you can get tossed out of a polling place if you wear a T-shirt or a button, but they left it up to the discretion of poll workers there to decide who gets tossed. So that may lead to some challenges. We'll be back in a minute with more on what to expect on Election Day here and now. We're talking about the flurry of lawsuits and legal opinions as Election Day approaches. Today's New York Times highlights the so-called placeholder lawsuits that campaigns have filed recently in several states, including Colorado and Pennsylvania, so that the parties can hedge their bets and take their cases to court after the election if they feel that it's close. Edward Foley is an elections law expert and professor at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. And now we've been looking at active lawsuits. Yesterday, the NAACP in Virginia dropped its lawsuit there, seeking to place more voting machines and backup ballots in neighborhoods with large minority populations and also to keep the polls there open longer. Now, the state said it doubled its supply of machines since 2004. But is it an issue, where the machines go?
Yes. We saw in 2004 that it's not just the volume of machines overall in a particular state or a particular county, but it is the allocation of those machines in different locations within a single county. The length of the ballot can be different. So if you're in one city in a county, you may vote on a school funding levy. You may vote for mayor this year and city council, but in the town right next door, the ballot is much shorter because that town's mayor is not up until next year. And there are some demographic considerations. You know, certain neighborhoods, the average amount of voting tends to be different for whatever reason. So there's some judgment here. Now, an interesting experiment is being conducted in Ohio, in Franklin County, where the state capital is. They've hired some social scientists to attempt to model this issue and plan for it in a more sophisticated way. So we'll be able to look at the results of this experiment, if you will, to see whether there's more sophisticated standards for how to allocate machines.
Well, given all the problems, let's make sure we get some advice in. Federal law now requires that all first-time voters who register by mail provide identification when they vote. So bring your ID. And if you're required to show one, make sure it's the kind of ID your polling place will accept. For instance, first-time voters in Pennsylvania can use a firearm permit or a utility bill. And Indiana, students at state schools can use their student IDs, but private school students can't. And another piece of advice I know you share, don't leave without getting at least a provisional ballot. This isn't the regular ballot. It's the ballot you cast if there are questions, if you don't have the right ID or there's some kind of database mismatch problem. You write, these provisional ballots and the various state rules that govern them could be the hanging chad of 2008. What do you mean?
Well, I agree 100% that no voter should leave without casting some kind of ballot. If you're standing in line and you get to the point where you're ready to vote and they say, well, you can't vote because there's a question about your registration and your eligibility to vote, therefore you can only vote provisionally. That's a circumstance where the voter should vote provisionally and then do everything they can to satisfy the eligibility standard. That may be, and in Florida you have, I think, 48 hours to go back and supply missing ID. If it's a mismatch, you can say, I am who I say I am. Here's some more documentation for my address.
Well, what happens if you get to cast your vote and they tell you, oh, you're in the wrong polling place?
That's harder, because if they are right about that, and you're in one of the states that requires you to be in the right polling place, then your provisional ballot will do you no good. And so if you have the time, I mean, it's obviously frustrating, get to the correct polling place.
Professor, I just want to ask you, a lot of people have made allegations that the election could be stolen. We know that John McCain said that Acorn, because of some of the problems with its voter registration drive, may be on the verge of perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country. Acorn, of course, has said that it itself flags problems that it sees with voter registration. On the other side, you have Democrats who are convinced that the elections in 2000 and 2004 were stolen. Robert Kennedy Jr. Wrote about Republicans in Ohio in 2004 preventing 350,000 votes from being cast or counted. New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller argues that the way Republicans stole the elections in Ohio in 2004 was by inserting their own stealth computer to siphon off election results, doctor them, and feed them back into the tabulating system. He makes this charge. He says they're going to do it again. Do you believe these charges that an election can be stolen?
I think it's very difficult to steal an election, especially a visible one like a presidential election. It's hard to steal on that scale. Even as rare as mistakes are, we're more likely to suffer from mistakes than we are from a plot. There are obviously people who say that 2004, the presidential race, especially in Ohio, was stolen by conspiracy. You know, my examination of the evidence does not warrant that conclusion. You know, Ohio did not run an election properly. But the key thing to look for is the ratio of the problems to the margin of victory. And the margin of victory was 120,000 votes. Still pretty close, you know, when millions are cast. But 120,000 vote victory is a big enough margin that it can withstand problems that are in the order of magnitude of tens of thousands. And that's, I think, the most important takeaway message to think about as we look to Tuesday and how to understand what may happen on Tuesday. There will be problems, unfortunately. It won't be perfect. But if the margins of victory state by state are wide enough, we can reach a judgment that the election was sound in the sense that it produced an accurate winner, even if the precise vote total down to the last single digit might not be accurate. Now, again, I think because of Florida and 2000, people understandably sometimes have trouble distinguishing the two different scenarios. You know, I, for one, think that 2000 was an election where the system broke down to the extent that it was incapable of accurately identifying the winner. And so that, to my mind, is a important distinction between 2000 on the one hand and 2004 on the other. There were definitely problems in both, but the problems in 2004 did not undermine the integrity of the counting process in the way that the problems in 2000 did.
Edward Foley, professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, looking ahead to Tuesday and flagging us on some of the problems we might see then. Ned, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Still ahead, crossing party lines after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The presidential candidates are in overdrive for this last weekend of campaigning before Tuesday's vote. And with the clock change, remember, fall back, they get an extra hour. Barack Obama is sending out text messages. That sound heralds the message, help Obama get out the vote at a phone bank this weekend. Senator John McCain is doing traditional canvassing and also using phone banks. And both campaigns are getting help from members of the opposition. Today, we want to take a look at voters who are switching party allegiance on Tuesday. And we'll start with some renegade Democrats. McCain campaign officials say Democrats for McCain made 48,000 calls in Scranton this week alone. And busloads of Democrats from New York and New Jersey have traveled to Pennsylvania to campaign. Some of these people switching are former Hillary Clinton supporters, including Diane Manchuvelis. She's a branding consultant in Miami. She supported Hillary Clinton in the primary and is now organizing Democrats to get behind McCain. And Diane, tell us, first of all, what are you doing to get out the vote for McCain?
Well, Robin, our effort from the inception of our group, JustSayNoDeal.com, has been really viral on the internet. So we're leveraging our massive database of Hillary Clinton supporters who back in June decided to just say no deal to Barack Obama, deploying them around the country.
Tell us some of the places you've sent people.
Well, Pennsylvania has been a state where John McCain has been gaining some ground, and a lot of New Yorkers who were rabid Hillary Clinton supporters have been busing into Scranton every single weekend and canvassing for John McCain. Many wear their Hillary Clinton hats and T-shirts, but they're carrying John McCain signs, and it's sort of confusing for people because they drive by or they watch them and they say, what's that about? And people stop them on the street, and many say, listen, we're voting for McCain, but we just, you know, we're keeping it to ourselves. So I do think there are some wild cards here.
People are sort of encountering you and others, Democrats for McCain, and saying, we thought we were the only ones, we're keeping it quiet.
That's exactly what we're hearing.
Tell us something. Why are you supporting the McCain-Palin ticket?
You know, it does seem to defy logic. But, you know, this entire year has been a truly emotional year for voters around the country, myself included. If someone told me a year ago I would be voting for a Republican, I'd tell them they were absolutely insane. I've always rejected Republicans. I was sort of raised to reject Republicans. But what I've discovered this summer, we actually have more in common than the leadership would ever have you believe. I think Senator Obama still has far too many unanswered questions for me.
Well, you've also said that it was Palin that helped you make up your mind, despite disagreements on some of the issues. Why? What was it about her?
You know, I am pro-choice. I've always voted Democrat. And yet I love Sarah Palin. I actually went to the St. Paul convention, and I thought, this gal's pretty terrific. She's a mom of five. She manages an $11 billion budget in Alaska. She has sass and wit and seems like the type of person who could really get it done. And because she doesn't have the inside Washington Wall Street connections, to me, that's a positive thing.
What's funny, Diane, is that polls are showing that most Americans feel exactly the opposite. In fact, her negativity has just gone up 9 points in some polls, and some are saying she's a drag on the Republican ticket. But here, she pulled you in.
Well, you know, I have a theory on that, Robin. I believe the Obama campaign has run the most brilliant campaign this year. They've effectively rebranded Sarah Palin. When she came out on the national stage, she was a reformer. She was the hockey mom. She was the gal that was going to go in and sweep Washington. What they did is they rebranded her, you know, with the lipstick on a pig comment, and many people discounted that, although a few media outlets did not. I happen to believe that that was intentional, and I think that that was just the beginning. Mm. And, you know, it does work. When people watch negative coverage of a candidate, eventually it does stick.
Well, Dan, I have to say that many Republicans are saying that it's Sarah Palin who did this to herself. These were self-inflicted wounds because of her interviews. But I do want to move on to another point,
sure,
because I think it's interesting. What happens, what do other Democrats say to you when you say you're voting for McCain?
Well, I'm only speaking to friendly Democrats right now. I've lost friends over this. I have friends I've known for 20 years who reject my position and who have said things that have really offended me about Sarah Palin. And, you know, what we try to do is we reach out to Hillary Clinton supporters. We're not reaching out to Barack Obama supporters. Hillary Clinton supporters are seeing today the attacks on Sarah Palin as similar as what they saw on Hillary Clinton earlier this year. We had two fantastic candidates. If Sarah Palin fails miserably next week, it will not be because she's unqualified. It will be because she was attacked. So, yes, I do think women really got the short end of the stick this year. Personally, I do think this election is about choice. Do I choose to reward the party that rewarded sexism, allowed it to go unchecked by the media, the Democratic Party, even the Obama campaign? Or do I take a look at the party, the Republican Party, the good old boy network that has never embraced women's issues, but actually put their money where their mouths are by putting a woman on the ticket? To me, that speaks volumes.
That's Diane Manchuvelis from Miami, originally from Boston, a lifelong Democrat who is going out to campaign for John McCain. Diane, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, some high-profile Republicans have defected to the Obama camp in recent weeks. Of course, former Secretary of State Colin Powell among them. John Martin is a 30-year-old law student in Queens, New York, who started a website, Republicans for Obama. And, John, you worked on Rudy Giuliani's campaign. Why the switch for you?
Well, this is a one-time thing. I feel as though Barack Obama is a unique politician. Many Republicans have gotten sick of the intense partisanship that we've seen over the past 8 years and even 20 years. So Barack Obama we see as being a real uniter. He doesn't demonize Republicans. He talks about bringing people together.
What are you and others doing to help him get elected?
The main thing we did, as you mentioned, we started our website, republicansforobama.org. We started that back in December 2006. And this was really just an effort to begin organizing Republicans from throughout the country who are supporting Barack Obama or who are thinking about it. So people have used that site to meet people in their local communities, to exchange ideas, basically just to support each other.
How many of you got signed up?
So far we have 2,500 people from throughout the country.
And you get about 10,000 visitors a day, we understand?
That's right.
What do other Republicans say to you about this?
Well, obviously we get mixed messages. We get people who obviously are very upset, who say that we are not, in fact, actual Republicans, that a real Republican could not support Barack Obama. And then, of course, we get many people who are extremely happy to find us and to find a community of people who are feeling the way they do.
You say that you don't like the partisanship and that Obama has, not demonized the Republican Party. You like that about him. But aren't there social issues that you disagree with him on?
I'm pro-life, but a lot of Republicans for Obama resent how our party has place so much of an emphasis on social issues just as a way to kind of rally their base and to distract us from bread and butter issues like the economy.
And by the way, you know, some are saying that the Republican Party is in a real schism right now. Your thoughts?
I agree with it. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, obviously, a group like ours is a symptom of that schism. It's going to be interesting to see how the party regroups or does not regroup after Election Day.
Yeah. And by the way, on Election Day, are you voting for other Democrats?
No, I'm not. I'm voting the party line. I've been volunteering for a local congressman here in the New York area who's a Republican. So I will be voting the Republican Party line, but I will be making one exception and voting for Barack Obama.
John Martin, founder of the website Republicans for Obama. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Quick note on two of the stories we're working on here. We'll take a look at how the TV show Mad Men tells us about how Madison Avenue began selling everything from toothpaste to politicians. And we'll also look at the federal regulations that the Bush administration is reconsidering in its waning days regarding the environment. That's coming up in the coming days. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's hear what you have to say. We reported this week on short sales. That's when homeowners have to sell their home for less than they owe on it. And sometimes the banks forgive that difference. So homeowners should check that out. But Tan and Hardy of Mundy Realty in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, wrote with this caveat. She says, in many instances, lenders will send the seller a 1099 tax form for the value they've forgiven because they see it as income they've given to the seller. So the buyer is hit with a double whammy. They lose their house, and because of a 1099 for $30,000 or $40,000, they now have a larger tax bill. Some lenders will negotiate whether or not you receive a 1099, but many will not. Well, Tannen, thanks for that advice. And we also got some insight yesterday from Ryan Chittum. He is a business reporter with firsthand experience of foreclosure. His family home was foreclosed when he was a kid. He wrote about that for the Columbia Journalism Review, and some review readers didn't believe the part of the story when his parents said they didn't know that they'd signed a mortgage with an ARM, an adjustable interest rate that shot up. Well, Eric Rimes of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, did believe it. He writes, my wife and I obtained a mortgage a few years ago, and I was very clear that I did not want to have any adjustable interest rate. What the mortgage broker did was forget to mention that we needed two loans, and the second mortgage was adjustable. Sadly, I only caught this after signing the papers. With cars, there are lemon laws and other protections that require the seller to be extremely clear. Why don't the same things apply to houses? Well, we also spoke recently with Pamela Ross of Washington, North Carolina, the mother of a child with Down syndrome, who said she was supporting Sarah Palin, who also has a son with Down syndrome, because she believes that Palin can only benefit the special needs community. That provoked this call from Lori McCrae of New Hampshire. She points out that Joe Biden was the co-sponsor of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act back in 1975, and Barack Obama is co-sponsor of the Community Choice Act, which, if passed, would provide funds to help disabled people live at home. John McCain has expressed concern about the costs. Here's Lori's conclusion.
I have a 19-year-old son with Down syndrome. To watch him grow, have him become a paid, employed adult, having graduated from high school, and now he'll be voting in his first presidential election. If people look beyond the emotional tug of the commonality of having a baby with Down syndrome and actually look at the people in our Congress and legislature that have supported young children with Down syndrome, it has been Democrats all along. Hands down, it's going to our votes in our family, including my son's first presidential vote, will go to Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
Alan Field of Winchester, Massachusetts, wrote after our piece on the huge and endangered leatherback turtles off the coast here in Boston, and we decided to call him because, Alan, we understand you were once a volunteer, this was years ago in Puerto Rico, and you monitored the leatherbacks as they laid their eggs, and you actually touched them. Now, this was extraordinary to us. Tell us what you did.
It would be at nighttime. We'd go down to the beach and wait until we saw that one had actually come up, and the turtle would delicately dig this deep hole and lay the eggs. But they would tend to cover the hole with their rear flipper, so you'd have to hold the flipper aside while they're looking down and counting the eggs with a flashlight and a little number counter. That's what we did. It was really very moving because the leatherbacks really were alive at the time of the dinosaurs, and so they are truly ancient beasts, and it's just amazing to think that you're having physical contact with something that is genetically so ancient and so far removed from us.
You're right. You held their wonderfully fleshy and supple rear flippers. I mean, it just sounds extraordinary. But
yeah.
In our segment, I asked what the purpose of the leatherbacks was. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, bats eat mosquitoes. But you didn't like that question. Why?
Yeah, well, I sort of reacted to that because the idea of it purpose is kind of a human perspective, but I don't think that they have a purpose. They exist because they have survived. But there is, I should add, they are part of the web of nature, and they, for example, they eat jellyfish.
But just being, because they are so glorious, is enough for you.
That's enough for me. They exist.
And finally, Mary DeRosier of Harrisville, New Hampshire, wrote with thanks for our segment on Girl Talk, a.k.a. Greg Gillis, who mashes other people's songs together to forge his own music. She writes, Greg is one of the few artists that my Gen Y daughter, my college-age sons, and I, the grizzled-aged hippie, agree on. Greg is just brilliant, and it's fun when I recognize the old Chubby Checker, Four Tops, or Carole King lick and am able to appear knowledgeable. As always, we want to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Back in a minute. More music here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Most of the country returns to standard time this weekend, and the way we see it, that means more time for music at night. Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs, the Duke of After Dark, joins us now to recommend some new music that will sound especially good after the sun goes down. James, hello.
Greetings, Robin, and indeed I have been walking through my dukedom.
Your dukedom.
Yes.
Well, we know you want to begin today with a gorgeous collaboration between the Panamanian-born and now Boston-based pianist Danilo Perez and the German arranger Klaus Ogerman, Across the Crystal Sea. We're listening to the title track. Now, who wrote this?
Robin, this is an adaptation of a piece by Hugo Distler, a 20th century German composer who primarily wrote choral works for the church.
It's just beautiful. Tell us more about the CD.
It's on the MRC label, and it is indeed a beauty from beginning to end. Danilo Perez is among our most inventive younger pianists. Lately, he's been part of Wayne Shorter's group. As for Klaus Ogerman, he's 78 years old and is justifiably acclaimed for his string writing, which is emotional but always controlled. Ogerman picks his spots as to when and with whom he records, and among his credits are albums with Frank Sinatra, Antonio Carlos Jobim, Michael Brecker, and Diana Krall. Mm. But the spiritual antecedent of this album with Danilo Perez is a 1965 disc which Ogerman arranged called Bill Evans Trio with Symphony Orchestra. This piece by Bach is called Valse.
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, it really is. The Bill Evans Trio with Symphony Orchestra featured adaptations of other European classical selections, plus originals by Evans and Ogerman.
Well, how nice to hear it. But again, you say this was the forerunner of Klaus Ogerman's new collaboration with Danilo Perez, Across the Crystal Sea.
It was, Robin, and the Perez-Ogerman CD follows the same script. Some new takes on classical pieces, plus an Ogerman original. But Robin, let's go back to the music. I want to hear a little bit more of Danilo Perez's piano work. And by the way, the CD was engineered exceptionally by Al Schmidt. What a ravishing sound he gets.
Danilo Perez playing piano. His collaboration with Klaus Ogerman is called Across the Crystal Sea. Okay, what's next?
Robin, we've got one of my two all-time favorite singing pianists. The first is Nat Cole, and the second is the woman we're about to hear, the late Shirley Horn. Mm-hmm. She and her trio are in the spotlight live at the 1994 Monterey Jazz Festival, which happens to be the title of this new disc from the MJF imprint of Concord Jazz Records.
What is it about Shirley Horn that, I mean, you know, you're second behind Nat Cole,
yeah,
favorite singer. What is it that you love so much?
Well, for one thing, she is an excellent pianist in her own right, and she accompanies herself as no one else ever could. Whenever she only sang while working with another pianist, it was never quite the same. Mm. Then there's her elocution, her sultry voice, and her absolutely unhurried sense of time. Her ballads moved at a near glacial pace, but that only made them more sensual. Listen to how she treats The Look of Love, a song closely associated with another favorite singer of mine, Dusty Springfield. Mm-hmm. It's the Shirley Horn Trio. They're live at Monterey.
The look of love is saying so much more than just words could ever say. But what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away.
Shirley Horn taking her time.
Oh, yeah.
On the live at the 1994 Jazz Festival CD.
That tremolo piano thing in the background, so cool.
Beautiful. And that's her playing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. As always, we're going to have a list of James' picks at our website, here-now.org. So let's hear the next one, because this is someone everyone knows, but they probably don't know this recording. It's Frank Sinatra on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky Strike Light Up Time Shows.
Can't have a show called that anymore.
No, thankfully. No. Tell us about this one.
Well, in 1949 and 1950, when the master's voice was beginning to fade a bit in the collective American consciousness, that is, Frank Sinatra hosted a nightly radio program that ran just 15 minutes. He'd sing a couple of songs, tell a joke or two, and his special guest for that particular evening would do a tune as well. And that pretty much was it.
Huh.
Now then, Acrobat Music's premier collection has brought us this package of Sinatra on the Radio. It's part of a series, by the way, that also includes Dave Brubeck and Carmen McRae and Miles Davis.
Huh.
At times, it presents Frank strictly off the cuff, but it also offers some prime Sinatra balladry. The number I've chosen, I think, is the most emotionally powerful ballad of them all, Body and Soul. And here, Sinatra's special guest, playing the trumpet obbligati and a sublime solo, is Bobby Hackett.
My life a wreck you're making. You know I'm yours for just the taking. I would gladly surrender myself to you, body.
You know, isn't that something? Can you imagine, you know, 15 minutes here and there sprinkled throughout current programming, you know?
Many just radio programs lasted only 15 minutes in those days.
What if we had that today? Oh, yeah. Wouldn't that be something? Okay, Frank Sinatra on the air, 1950, the next selection.
I want you to just listen first.
I am just hearing a sax and a bass.
A tenor saxophone and a bass. Just the two of them in a series of intimate improvisational conversations. The tenor player is Houston Person, whose approach recalls both the heartfelt tone of Gene Ammons and the lyricism of Stan Getz. The bassist is the peerless, ubiquitous, infinitely melodic Ron Carter. And again, I must point out the engineer, because in this case, it's jazz's most renowned recorder of sound. Ooh, a couplet there. Rudy Van Gelder. The tune is Irving Berlin's How Deep is the Ocean, and it's from the high note disc called Just Between Friends. Let's listen to Houston Person and Ron Carter talk.
They're talking. It's kind of like, how you doing? Fine, you.
Oh, yeah. Back and forth.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Some music to get you through the night or day.
Mm-hmm.
And James, we understand you have one more selection.
Yeah, I thought we'd hear one more track from this extraordinary Danilo Perez and Klaus Ogerman album, Across the Crystal Sea. This is based on a piece by the Spanish composer Manuel de Falla. The title is Purple Condor.
So, music for a romantic evening, or tonight, something to chill out the kids.
For Halloween. And, of course, I'll be going as the Duke of the After Dark.
That's right.
Okay.
James, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin.